Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking ahead to the general election, which is now just days away. We'll be asking whether Theresa May might conceivably have blown her chances, and we'll be discussing whether Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister is as unlikely as ever. And for some light relief, we'll also be considering the role that handwriting plays in our digital society. First, on to next week's election. In this week's issue of the magazine, James Forsyth says that there are no winners. At the start of this campaign, Theresa May looked strong and stable, but it has exposed weaknesses in both her methods and her policies. James joins me now, along with Tim Shipman, political editor for the Sunday Times. So James, what's gone wrong?
Well, I think at the start of this campaign, it seemed like it was going to be 1983 for the Tories. They were going to win a big majority, and that was going to define Theresa May as the big political figure of the age. And instead, the campaign, I think, has turned out more like 1987. It hasn't been a great Tory campaign. The Labour campaign appears to have outperformed it. And there are definitely some wobbles. You know, the Tories started off with a 24-point lead in the polls. We're now talking about opinion polls which show the Tory majority actually shrinking from what Theresa May inherited from David Cameron. Now, look, I personally don't think those polls are right. I think those people on the ground, whose judgment I most respect, think it is about a 12-point race. But what is certainly true is that Theresa May, in seeking to kind of consummate her marriage with the British electorate, has ended the honeymoon. The kind of sense that May is this invincible figure has gone. And I think before this campaign, Theresa May was a blank canvas onto which, it was one of those people closest to her said, onto which people projected what they wanted to see. They wanted to give her the benefit of a doubt. So if she appeared uncomfortable on television, it was because she wasn't a slick salesman like Cameron or Blair. This election campaign has given her more definition, but I think it has cost her that support. And I think the U-turn on social care has definitely done damage to her. It's done damage to her in two ways. First, because lots of traditional Tories who liked her thought that she was one of them, thought, oh, maybe she isn't. And secondly, the general public who saw her as this strong, decisive leader have been like, what's she doing U-turning like that?
Tim, do you think, as James suggests, the campaign's been a disaster for everyone involved?
Well, I don't think it's probably been a disaster for Jeremy Corbyn, whose goal is to get a bigger vote share than Ed Miliband and hold on to the leadership of the Labour Party. And I think in the Labour Party, the people who are in despair are probably the moderates who are hoping that there would be catastrophe and that they would have A, an excuse to take back over the Labour Party, or B, form some kind of new arrangement. But I do think it's, as James says, I think his analysis is spot on in terms of Theresa May. What it reminds me of is a US presidential election where the candidates are exposed to the public, warts and all, and the public gets a sense of people in a campaign in a way that they don't from just tuning in and looking at the television news a couple of times a week. And Theresa May was not tested in that way during the Conservative leadership election. We thought we'd have a contest that lasted throughout the summer, but Andrea Leadsom imploded very quickly. And Theresa May sort of inherited the world largely unknown, more unknown than any Prime Minister has been since probably back in the 1970s. And as a consequence, that sort of tabula rasa of that people could impose their own vision on has gone. And she has defined herself, and in ways that are not terribly popular with a lot of people.
James, do you think it's been a mistake to make this election quite so presidential in tone?
I think it clearly has been, in that they have stopped doing that. They are now trying to offer a broader-based offer. I think their desire was to get this May-Corbyn contrast highlighted. They thought that was their strongest suit. I think there was another reason, though. And I think that's one of the reasons why, for example, you haven't seen Boris Johnson. Theresa May and her people around her, they wanted a personal mandate for her and for her very distinct version of conservatism. And that meant that she had to be front and centre, not anybody else. So, you know, Boris Johnson, don't use him too much because he's never the supporting actor. He's always the star. And I think there is a problem here, which is they haven't really managed to land their blows on Jeremy Corbyn. Indeed, I think the kind of only effective anti-Corbyn day the Tories have really had was when Boris Johnson called him a mugwump. And it kind of got going. It got kind of traction in the public mind. It kind of kept going as a story. And so I think that is a problem. I think the other issue is that when everything was going well, she was kind of sailing above this, and the idea that she should, you know, she could skip the television debate that's taking place tonight on the grounds that, you know, what's the point in her turning up to that? As this campaign has gone on, she hasn't managed to find another gear. She hasn't managed to, you know, Cameron was very good at this. If the polls tightened, you know, we'd all get told he was rewriting his stump speech, and he would come out and he'd audibly go through the gears.
Tear off his shirt and show us his muscles.
No,
I mean,
exactly.
It was, you know, high drama.
And Theresa May is not a theatrical politician, and she doesn't have a kind of way to change, I mean, it's a kind of phrase that they hate, but a way to change the narrative and get back onto the front foot.
Do you think people are finding Corbyn actually more charming as a politician.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who've heard, you know, the terrible things that lots of us have written about Jeremy Corbyn, rightly pointing out a degree of chaos and incompetence in his operation, have taken one look at this guy and thought, here's a relatively charming character. And the problem that team may have, to put it kindly, is that they have made a virtue of the fact that the Prime Minister is not a deeply charismatic and exciting politician. But the question then arises during a campaign as to whether it's simply that that's one of her virtues, or that is that it now begins to look like a limitation, I think it's fair to say. And the other thing with May that I think is significant is that a lot of people, MPs, ministers, to some degree journalists as well, have known Theresa May's faults for a very long time, but she has enjoyed this sort of commanding position in the opinion polls and a sense that the public out there enjoys this sort of honest provincial politician. And they've been reluctant to say anything negative, as I'm sure James will attest. Our phones are now buzzing with Cameroon people saying, well, they slagged us off and now they're finding out that politics isn't nearly so easy as they thought it was. And MPs and ministers who are sort of saying, you know, keep up the good work in exposing some of these problems because we haven't dared to say this stuff. So I think this has implications not just for the kind of majority that Theresa May might get, but for how easy it will be to control her party after the election.
When Tim writes his post-election book, I mean, there's a whole chapter to be done on the cabinet's train journey and then bus ride to the manifesto launch. Because I think what happened on that journey was that basically they all realised that no one had any clue what was going in the manifesto. And I think they all realised that how much of they were being used as a backdrop. And I think there is this weird thing, which is when she first came in, she made this whole thing of restoring the proprieties of cabinet government. You know, this wasn't going to be the Cameron-style chumocracy. It was going to be different. And I think what ministers have now realised is that if a decision doesn't matter, they all get consulted. But on the really important things, it's been decided by four people. I think that is beginning to grate with them. I mean, it is quite remarkable how many ministers, including ministers who are very heavily involved in the Tory election effort, didn't know about things that were in the manifesto that were, at the very least, indirectly in their area of departmental responsibility.
Tim, do you think it's fair to say that voters at this point have no idea what they'll get if they vote Tory aside from Theresa May?
I think that's true to some degree, but they know some of the things they'll get and they don't like them. A lot of the stuff that went in the manifesto was sort of tough lessons, and it's a suggestion that life might be slightly more difficult going forward. And I think that was the problem with the manifesto. We all assumed when the story about care was briefed to the newspapers the night before that they would have some great reveal in the manifesto itself with some good news that would take that away from the headlines the following day. And it turned out there wasn't anything. So Theresa May has made a virtue of, you know, I'm the serious politician for tough times, but on one level, punters would quite like at least some hope that they might be coming out of tough times in the years ahead.
I think they've made a mistake on the deficit, because they've taken the deficit off the table as a political weapon by not saying when they will deal with it by. And that means, though, that when Labour promised more and more spending, you know, abolish tuition fees, do this, do that, the Tories don't have an obvious riposte. You know, in the 2015 campaign, the Tories say, but what about the deficit? You will never close the deficit
long-term
if you do that.
Economic plan.
Exactly. They can't do that this time round. That means that they are, weirdly enough, they are committed to austerity in terms of their plans, but they're not getting any of the political benefits of being the party that are going to deal with the deficit.
And that is why, if you've been reading the London Evening Standard in the last week or so, you will have read a series of coruscating leader pieces signed off by George Osborne, which have been referring to May and her team as economically illiterate, which is a phrase we've heard before in connection with some people around the Treasury. But the delight with which Osborne has been deploying that term is entirely based on the fact that his economic plan has been torn up and thrown in the dustbin.
Do you think Jeremy Corbyn's really doing better? Or is it just that Theresa May isn't doing as well as hoped, so by comparison he looks like he's doing better?
I think what you've got is Theresa May isn't meeting people's expectations and Jeremy Corbyn is exceeding them. I think one of the other things that Jeremy Corbyn has done is, I always thought Jeremy Corbyn's greatest weakness was his temper, that he got very tetchy very quickly with difficult questioning. In this campaign, he's kept his calm. You know, I thought when we had that Sky Channel 4 thing the other night, it was kind of very telling. There were some tough questions from the audience about, you know, his sympathy for the IRA, whether he'd made Labour unelectable. Corbyn always kept his temper. And I think that what's going on is people expect to see this person who they expect to see this kind of left-wing crazed, left-wing firebrand. And instead he's coming across more as a kind of, you know, slightly avuncular uncle. And I think therefore Corbyn is seeming more reasonable to people than he actually is.
Just finally, let's talk about Brexit, because Theresa May's reputation has taken a hit in Britain. Do you think it's also taken a hit abroad as we go into the Brexit negotiations in September?
Well, the anecdotal evidence is yes. If you listen to what ambassadors in London are saying and to some of the noises coming out of the European Commission and Berlin and other places, people there are watching this very closely, and they're seeing a prime minister who made a virtue of never backing down, who abandoned the centrepiece of her manifesto 4 days after it was published, which is the first time that has ever happened in a British general election. So they're looking on with great interest at this and thinking, you know, is Theresa May a pushover? They know her quite well. They know essentially that she isn't a pushover because they've dealt with her before. But they find her very mysterious and they don't really understand where she's coming from. And anecdotally, you hear that in their meetings with Theresa May, she says as little to them as she says to the British press or to her fellow MPs. And that's becoming a frustration for people in Brussels who are used to doing negotiations based on deep and long-standing personal relationships. And they don't really have that with Theresa May. So she's at best a mystery to them. And potentially they're seeing one that they might be able to push around.
I think the greatest danger for Theresa May in this election campaign is that her own domestic U-turns get turned into how can she stand up to Brussels if she does this, which hasn't happened yet so far. And I don't think there is enough time left with just a week to go for that to happen. I think Tim is completely right about this. One of the reasons why the Juncker, May, Selmayr dinner was such a disaster was that Jean-Claude Juncker is the ultimate kind of EU backroom operator. He thought behind closed doors in Downing Street they were going to get down to brass tacks. Instead, they found her saying exactly in private what she says in public. And they were like, what on earth is going on? I do think, though, one thing that is worth noticing here is I think before this election campaign in European capitals, if they'd heard that Theresa May had run into trouble, they would think, it is because the British public is coming to its senses over Brexit. That's not happening at all. You know, this is her troubles are not Brexit. And indeed, you know, it is telling that now that she is in trouble in this campaign, she is going back to Brexit at every single opportunity. You know, in the other night in that TV event, when she was in that tough interview, the way she got the audience back on side was to start saying no deal is better than a bad deal. So there is a kind of weird paradox here, which is Theresa May is coming out of this election weaker, but I think the public consensus on Brexit is coming out of it stronger because the Liberal Democrats have completely failed to launch with their pitch for a second referendum. I mean, it is quite remarkable that the party basically saying to the 48% of people who voted to remain, don't worry, we can overturn this referendum result if you vote for us, it looks like it's going to make one seat gain overall in the entire general election.
Well, and may lose some others. I mean, you asked earlier whether this was a disaster for everyone. I think it's almost most clearly a disaster for Tim Farron and the Lib Dems. I mean, every journalist in Britain was confidently predicting they were going to win 20 to 30 seats a month ago. And now it looks quite difficult for them even to hold on to what they've got. Vince Cable will probably win, and he may well be the next leader of the party. And if Farron didn't want to go, he would have to be ousted and the majority of his MPs would have to vote against him. Well, that might be four by the time we're finished.
Just finally, do you think there's still any prospect of a huge Tory majority?
I think there is, in that what I would say, so if it is a 12-point race, you are looking at a Tory majority of 80. I think in some ways these polls that suggest tightening will kind of bring Tory voters home. I mean, one thing you hear from Tory canvassers on the doorstep is that people don't like the unnecessary elections, they don't like the idea of being taken for granted. And that some people who at the start of the campaign were prepared to vote Tory despite being lifelong Labour voters kind of slightly recoiled when the idea got going that the Tories were going to have this 100-seat majority and be completely unrestrained. I still think in my bones that the British public are simply not ready to elect someone who 2 years ago we all would have said was too left-wing to lead even the Labour Party as Prime Minister. But I think that even if Theresa May does come back with a thumping majority, I think this campaign will have weakened her. Because it will be because of Corbyn, not at the start of his campaign, you'd have thought it was a combination of Corbyn and her that would lead to a big Tory majority. It will now be seen in Westminster as being almost entirely because of Jeremy Corbyn's deficiencies, not her strengths.
I think that's right. I think we need to calibrate what we think a good result is and perhaps be slightly fairer to the Tories. Katy Perry, her former director of communications, said yesterday that they went into the campaign on the basis that they could get a majority of 50. I think most people would regard that as disappointing now. My view is that there's always 30 troublemakers on the Tory backbenches, so 60 really is the bare minimum that you want to be comfortable. If she can get to 80, she ought to be fairly pleased with that. There reaches a point where if you have too many backbenchers, they spend all their time causing trouble. But it will have a bearing on what happens. One of the most significant things is what she does with her cabinet, and she'll be distinctly emboldened about chucking half of them out if she has a majority into three figures. So I think it's highly likely that she gets a decent working majority, but it's quite hard to see her getting three figures right now.
That was James Forsyth and Tim Shipman.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, on to Jeremy Corbyn and whether he could actually become Prime Minister. In this week's issue, Chris Mullen, author of A Very British Coup, suggests that while it may still seem a fantasy, it might be worth considering what a Corbyn government would be like. I'm now joined by Nick Cohen and Katie Balls to discuss. So, Nick, you've said many times that Corbyn is beyond useless. How then to explain these polls which show that he's increasing Labour support?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, maybe they're true. I mean, we should say that. Certainly, come June the 9th, some polling companies, because there are some polling companies that show a very close race, others show a big Tory lead. You know, newspapers are going to have to decide if they've got a polling company that's got it wholly wrong, how in conscience they can carry on printing their findings as facts. And businesses will have to decide how they can keep hiring them to do their market research. It could be true. I doubt it, and these are anecdotal reasons, but every Labour MP I talk to says this is not true. What they're picking up in canvass returns and on the doorsteps, they don't believe it. Now, MPs can get things wrong. Scottish MPs at the last election who thought they would hang on to their seats and see off the SNP got it wrong. So it could be. I mean, there are good reasons for it to happen. I mean, if you are opposed to the Conservatives, as large parts of this country are, who on earth do you vote for? Lib Dems are nowhere. The Greens have been pretty much absorbed by Labour, so there's not much difference between the Corbyn wing of the Labour Party and the Greens. If you're sort of socially conservative Labour, UKIP is gone. Conservatives who focused on Jeremy Corbyn's undoubted failings and deformations have rather missed the point of, well, you've got to offer something as well. And I don't think Theresa May has very much. I don't think she can really explain why she's called this election. And in that sense, Labour could shoot up. But as I say, I would just like to hear people on the doorstep saying, yeah, Katie, yeah, everyone at Spectator, look, I see people returning to the fold. And I'm just not hearing that.
But Nick, during this podcast over the past few years, I've heard people say that Brexit couldn't happen. We've heard people say Trump couldn't happen. Mm. In the last few weeks, we've heard people saying Corbyn couldn't happen.
Sure.
Do you think we might have got it wrong again?
It could do. Really, what we're seeing is the dark years of the early 21st century unfolding. We've had 9/11. We've had war in Iraq with weapons of mass destruction, which weren't there. We've had mass immigration on an unprecedented scale. We've had the banks crash, recession, and then the public have to bail out the banks. And collapse in faith in institutions. And there's a right-wing populism, which says society, as it's organised, is a fraud, and the elite, the multicultural elite, con you by forcing Mexican rapists to use Trump's language and terrorist Muslims to use their language of right on you. And you've had left populists saying society's a giant swindle, they con you into fighting false flag, Islamophobic wars and in bailing out the banks. And it does work. It has worked for Trump. It did work on Brexit. And we will see. I would just add this one caution, though. The successes, Trump's and Brexit, have been nationalist movements. Nationalists and, I know people at Spectator are going to shout at me for saying this, but quasi-racist movements, or certainly nativist movements that say there's us and there's the foreigners. Corbyn's fatal flaw, I think a left populism could work, but Corbyn's fatal flaw is his lack of patriotism, his lack of identification with his country. And I wonder if people will overcome that and bring themselves to vote for him. Maybe they will.
Katie, plenty of people are saying that Jeremy Corbyn's had quite a good campaign, especially compared to Theresa May. Do you think that's winning people over, or is it more that the Labour brand is quite
quite strong still.
I think it's the best of both. He started off at such a low bar that he basically just had to get, you know, a fluent sentence out where he didn't sound like he wanted to betray his country in order to, you know, exceed expectations. And that's meant that all his media performances, he comes across as quite likeable. And that's amplified by the fact that everyone's been told he's not very likeable. And therefore, it's a low bar he rises from. I think the Tories have had a very bad campaign. Theresa May doesn't seem to have a grasp really on her party or what she wants her party to be. The Tory manifesto is where things really started to go wrong, whereas the Labour manifesto had a raft of quite popular policies. The Tory manifesto seems to be based on the idea that you can kind of give voters whatever and they'll have to deal with it because Jeremy Corbyn is so bad they're not going to vote for him. And actually, voters aren't going to take that. You can't just keep telling them they're not going to get nice things. So I think that's partly the Labour brand, people thinking that I can get past having a leader I don't like massively if I'm going to have these policies that will help my family.
Nick, do you think it's possible that Jeremy Corbyn's actually got wider appeal than Ed Miliband?
Hard to believe, but if you go beyond leaders, I would say that if you look at Britain, where there's so much hopelessness and so little optimism, where we are now in the biggest wage squeeze in 200 years, according to the Economist Resolution Foundation, where if you're young and you want to go for the normal rites of passage, buying a flat and getting a secure job, well, that's quite hard for you. It's not surprising that an opposition would do well. I mean, you can look at the Labour Party this week. I think if only Yvette Cooper were leading it, you know, if only they, Diane Abbott and Emily Formbury and John McDonnell weren't on the front bench, but Labour politicians who actually knew what they were doing were there. Well, maybe Conservatives could be out of power. I still think it'd be very hard after the Brexit vote, but still. So if you go beyond leaders and start looking at the state of the country and where parties are, it's not so surprising that there's a backlash against May.
But then I do think slightly in Jeremy Corbyn's favour is the fact that Green voters have gone to the Labour Party, or they seem to be doing so. And I think that's something that might not happen under a leader like Yvette Cooper. They like that Jeremy Corbyn could in a way be in the Green Party. There's lots of policies in common. And the votes so far, it looks like the UKIP vote has gone to the Tories. And what is boosting the Labour vote is the fact that these smaller, more left-wing parties are going to Labour, which is partly down to having what lots of people perceive to be a truly left-wing leader.
I mean, it's interesting this point, because you've suggested before that Corbyn might kill off the Labour Party, but what Katie's saying, what seems to be happening is almost a return to two-party politics. Do you think there's a chance he might be wrong and he might have actually saved the Labour Party?
Well, it depends what kind of Labour Party is emerging now. Suppose Corbyn doesn't win, which I don't think is such a big suppose. What will then happen is that his faction will say, it doesn't matter I've lost an election, it doesn't matter I've given the Tories a third victory in a row, I must stay and my faction must stay in control. Then, remember, not a single Labour MP was deselected before this election was called. Every single Labour MP was allowed to stand, and actually the party machine imposed candidates on the other constituencies because no one had chosen anyone because there had been no boundary review because a promised Tory redrawing of boundaries had never happened. After the election, then the left will try to purge the party. I mean, there's no doubt about whether they'll succeed is another matter because today's leftists are rather lazy and they don't go to meetings and pass composite resolutions like their forefathers did. But that's what will happen. So Labour will then become, in the end, will end up a party like the Mélenchon campaign in France or Die Linke in Germany. They will be completely different from this very strange, I think rather admirable, 20th century hybrid of combining social reform with love of country, with patriotism, able to talk to, as the cliche goes, hamsters and Hull at the same time. So if the far left hangs on for another 5 years, then they might save the Labour Party, but it would be an entirely different party with nothing in common with any Labour tradition apart from the tradition of Tony Benn. I mean, it would be an entirely different beast. And I think if they hang on as well, I mean, I know if they hang on, then there will be a split. I mean, people in Labour MPs are waiting for the election result. If Corbyn doesn't go, or if he's replaced by John McDonnell or one of Corbyn's supporters, and they think it's not worth fighting for anymore, then there will be a split. There'll be the most massive split.
Let's just imagine the unimaginable for a moment. What would a Corbyn government look like, Katie?
Well, I read somewhere he wasn't 100% sure he'd bother moving into Downing Street. So we might see, you know, an Islington power base. I think the thing with Jeremy Corbyn is he is very interested in foreign policy. That's where his passion is. And I think it would have serious repercussions for Britain's foreign policy. But at the same time, the way Parliament is set up and British democracy is that if you do have a leader with very strong views, there's still lots of measures, which mean they can't just do what they want. They still have to... There's enough measures in place that they can't do anything too crazy.
Can I just say something? If Jeremy Corbyn were to win the election, he wouldn't be Prime Minister, because there are enough Labour MPs who regard him as a threat to Britain who will refuse to vote for a motion of confidence in him. It would be the most extraordinary thing. And you would see, because the Labour Party itself has been very quiet in this election. Katie has written dozens of articles on car crash interviews as Diane Abbott and John McDonald and strange people at backbenchers.
Whoever that cartoon man is.
But all Labour's talent has just stayed in their constituencies, fighting to hold on to their seat, and they're saying, this is Corbyn's election, you own it. But when the new Parliament's called, they will be back. And I simply do not believe that however many Labour MPs there will be, say 200, if Labour were to win, 330 Labour MPs, I simply do not believe that all of them would vote in a motion of confidence put Corbyn and Downing Street. It wouldn't happen.
That was Nick Cohen and Katie Balls. And for more of Nick's thoughts on this election, do tune in next Monday to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast, where he's in conversation with Damian Thompson and Christina Adoni. On to our final topic, handwriting. In this week's issue of The Spectator, David Butterfield suggests that poor penmanship impoverishes us all. He joins me now, along with Simon Jenkins. So, David, why are you so concerned about the demise of handwriting?
Well, there's several reasons really that prompted me to take a step back and ask some open questions about handwriting. Some of those are practical, some of those are intellectual, and some are more broadly cultural and, I would confess, sentimental. The practical side of things is simply this. If we as a society are losing the ability to write legibly, then we are in a position where we can't record thoughts for anyone else unless we've got a device with us. If that's an electronic device, we need to be in a world where we can plug things in and therefore not removed from the world of technology. Or we're simply in a position where we can only speak to people, otherwise nothing can be recorded. So the practical concerns seem to me very serious, that if, as a society, we can't write things down for others without technology, then that doesn't seem to be a good thing at all. On the intellectual side, it seems to me there's a very great difference between being able to write with a word processing tool and being able to write by hand. Several studies show that writing by hand, a slower and much more difficult process, a process that indeed takes years to learn, ends up engaging the brain to a far greater degree by virtue of its sheer difficulty. Whereas writing on a computer, it's a much more fast-flowing, handheld process where the word processor will sort out a lot of the problems for you. And as I say in the piece, I think it's true that to write by hand is to think better by virtue of its slower pace and the more it demands from the brain. And finally, much more broadly and cultural, as I say, is this simple fact that we judge the development of cultures throughout the history of mankind by virtue of their discovery of an ability to write and an ability to record. And handwriting has been at the heart of that for millennia. If we are getting into a position where digital tools are removing from our lives the ability to write by hand, then we are letting lapse the fundamental unifying thread of civilization. So I'm not saying for a second, let's abandon digital devices. I am saying we do need to think about how to keep our handwriting legible and part of our everyday lives.
Simon, do you think that's fair, that to write by hand is to think better?
I don't know. I know when I moved from old-fashioned typewriters to word processors, I took longer to write because the first draft was rubbish because it was so easy. When you write a letter to someone, you do take a long while over it because you're terribly aware that you're going to have to rewrite it or cross it out if you don't get it right. I don't know. I'm always reluctant to say there's some huge new movement in culture, which undoubtedly word processing in the wide sense of the word is in some sense deleterious to culture. It's just a dangerous route to go down, in my view. I believe that handwriting is, as David says, somewhat integral to hand-eye coordination. It's the way in which you express your personality on page, other than just tapping away. It's also, to me, very beautiful, or it should be very beautiful. I mean, I studied calligraphy a bit, and I mean, the great calligraphers were, I mean, they went on about how the symbol of writing is the most wonderful thing mankind ever invented, and we owe it a huge amount of respect for that reason. If we're going to go back to squiggles and hieroglyphs, because we can't write cursive script anymore, that does seem to be a cultural lapse. But I don't know. I just think, like these Steiner schools in Silicon Valley, the new smart kids go to school with pencils, papers and rubbers and aren't allowed near a machine while they're inside the building. And that's what the whiz kids of the digital age want for their children. So, as always with cultural deteriorations, cultural advances tend to come hand in hand.
David, do you think there's any chance that our period might be viewed, as we see much of the medieval period, almost as a dark age?
Perhaps. I'm not being too histrionic and saying we can no longer write, but it's manifestly true that with our great dependency upon digital tools, which instantly give us a perfect, uniform appearance of text, our skill at handwriting is decreasing and illegibility is a bigger problem. If you extrapolate that and handwriting disappears from our school curricula entirely, then yes, it could well be the case that someone could not express themselves by handwriting, and as I say in the piece, couldn't sign their name but would merely mark it with an X to show they were present. I mean, as I say, I'm not saying that's the case, but it does follow that if the difficult process of handwriting isn't kept a part of our lives, then how would we be able to write?
I'm assuming that something replaces a classic cursive script. I mean, I was watching some kids trying to write the other day, and they were basically picking up on texting. And they were writing what we used to call speed writing, which is just short form writing. And I always thought one day that shorthand would take over from writing. Well, it never did. Mm. I don't quite see why not, because shorthand is actually a very legitimate form of writing. It's writing with George Bernard Shaw's re-spelling added in. So I just assume that somehow or other new forms of writing will take over, spurred on by digitization. So you know, we'd find new ways of expressing digitization in the written form. It's abundantly clear you've got to be able to write. I mean, I really can't believe the Finnish schools are stopping teaching writing. It just seems to be extraordinary. But I don't think that'll catch on. But I find it quite exciting. I just think handwriting will change. People have young people have a very refined sense of beauty. I mean, they're taught to draw. They're taught to, you know, they're almost taught calligraphy. So I'm not hopeless.
How are British schools addressing this problem?
Well, there's a great disjunct, actually, between primary and secondary education. In primary schools, it remains the case that in order to get the highest marks in your KS2, your Key Stage 2 examinations, you need to be able to join up your writing, that is, as Simon says, to write in a cursive fashion. However, at secondary schools, where there's almost no scope to focus on handwriting and to monitor it, nor are the teachers particularly trained in how to go about teaching it, handwriting is just allowed to run free. And for most, that means decline in its frequency and in its legibility. But nevertheless, all of our examination system is based upon people being put in a room and able to write fastly, succinctly and clearly. And their exam results are dependent upon an examiner being able to make sense of it. So it is rather odd that schools becoming, as we constantly hear, more and more obsessed about outcomes of examinations and not actually focusing upon the very medium by which people are judged at secondary school and indeed at university.
Well, maybe as an educator, you ought to proselytize more fiercely. I always remember that America, all Americans I know of a certain age, they all taught italic script back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, or whatever it was, and they all wrote the same. Mm. And they still do of a certain age. And I always used to think how utterly characterless American handwriting was.
And French too.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
I remember looking at French writing and wishing my handwriting looked like that because it was so neat. My handwriting was so messy. Just can I finally ask, how often do you put pen to paper, Simon?
I don't often. I mean, I do notes. I occasionally keep a diary note of something that's happened. And I do write thank you letters. I'm rather old-fashioned in that respect. I often think, what's the point? But I just do it. I mean, I did one today, and I really did find it quite difficult, partly because I couldn't read my own writing at times. So there's no doubt there's a change going on. I don't know if there's a problem. There's a change going on. But I don't know. I really do. I mean, I agree with David. I think this is an important part of our sort of cultural our own personal cultural personality. And if it really goes, which I don't think it will, it really would be very sad.
That was David Butterfield and Simon Jenkins. That's all for this week.
You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows too, including our books podcast, where this week Sam Leith is in discussion with the author Will Self. And if you like the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Simon Barnes, Laura Freeman and Andrew Watts. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.